Hello? Hello? Okay. I will assume you all hear me, ladies. Okay, not yet.
Mein Frauengenuss, mein Überfluss, mein Saus, mein Braus, du bist raus, ich bekomme Applaus.
So, ladies and gentlemen, dear human beings who do not wish to be classified in either of the two gender categories, and extraterrestrial visitors who are tuning in to a frequency. Full disclosure, we don't have a frequency, it's a web radio. Welcome to Talking Science, the most reliable source of news on science and technology at GKO, for those who have no idea about science or news. I'm Boyang, your host for the next half an hour. Talking Science is a new show that crawls the web for cutting-edge scientific discoveries and technological innovations and edit them into digestible sound bites for your convenience. To understand science, highly focused attention is required. So for best comprehensibility, listen to us while being asleep, in a lecture, or both. Now let's get sciencey. Today we'll talk about prawn studies, SpongeBob SquarePants and the likes of him or her, your gut bacteria and fat belly, the beauty of mathematics and other stuff. First story from EuroAlert. Mathematicians often describe mathematical formula in emotive terms, and experience of mathematical beauty has often been compared to the experience of beauty derived from the greatest art. You know, art. Well, like, I don't know. In a new paper published in Frontiers in Human Neuroscience, researchers used functional magnetic resonance imaging, that is a magnetic resonance imaging technology, to image the brain activity of 15 mathematicians when they viewed mathematical formulae that they had previously rated as beautiful, neutral, or ugly. The results showed that the experience of mathematical beauty correlates with the activity in the same part of the emotional brain, namely the medial orbital frontal cortex, which is in the frontal part of your cortex, I assume, as the experience of beauty derived from art or music. That means people who appreciate the beauty of mathematics activate the same part of the brain when they look at beautiful or pleasing formula as others do when they appreciate art or music, suggesting some kind of neural biological basis to beauty. In the study, each subject was given 60 mathematical formula to review and rate on a scale from minus 5 ugly to plus 5 beautiful, according to how beautiful they experienced them, so the formulae. And from minus 5 to plus 5, that is quite a large interval for mathematicians, concerning the fact that many of them don't encounter any numbers beyond 0 and 1. Well, anyway, so the formula most consistently rated as beautiful were Leonhard Euler's identity, the Pythagorean identity, and Cauchy-Riemann equations. Euler's identity, the exponential of the primary number multiplied with pi plus 1 equals 0, links 5 fundamental mathematical constants, that's e, pi, the imaginary number 1 and 0, with 3 basic arithmetic operations, that's plus, minus, and multiply, each of them occurring only once, not twice, which is so special. Wow. It's apparently so beautiful that some Shakespearean compared it to Hamlet's to be or not to be, or something like. The next story, also from EuroAlert. Have you ever looked a chicken deep into its eye? And if not, and if you are a material scientist, you definitely should get yourself a chicken. The unusual arrangement of cells in a chicken's eye constitutes the first known biological occurrence of a potentially new state of matter known as disordered hyperuniformity. According to researchers from Princeton University and Washington University in St. Louis, Research show that disordered hyperuniform materials have unique properties when it comes to transmitting and controlling light waves, which I assume is important for the eye as it is used to see things. So the states of disordered hyperuniformity behave like crystal and liquid of liquid states of matter, at the same time inhibiting order over large distances and disorder over small distances. So they are like crystals if you view them at large, and if you zoom in, then they look like liquid. And like crystals, they greatly suppress variations in the density of particles, so across large spatial distances. And the arrangement is then highly uniform, but at the same time, disordered hyperuniform systems are like liquids in that they have the same physical properties in all directions. The researchers studied the light-sensitive cells known as cones that are in the eyes of chickens and most other birds active in daytime. These birds have four types of cones for color: violet, blue, green, and red, and one type for detecting light levels. And each type of the cone have a different size. The cones are packed into a single layer of eye tissue called the epithelium, but not in the usual way nature works, so in many creatures' eyes. Visual cells are evenly distributed in an obvious pattern, such as the familiar hexagonal compact eye of insects. In many creatures, the different types of cones are laid out so that they are not near cones at the same time. At first glance, the cones in the chicken's eye appear to be spread with a shotgun, distributed in no particular order. But if you look closer, it turns out that each type of cone has an area around it called the exclusion zone, exclusion region that other cones cannot enter, and cones of the same type shut out each other more than they do unlike cones. And this variant exclusion causes distinct, very distinctive cone patterns. Each type of cone's pattern overlays the pattern of another cone so that the formations are intertwined in an organized but disordered way, so a kind of uniform disarray, or a disarrayed uniformity. So while it appears that the cones were irregularly placed, the distribution was actually uniform over large distances. That's called the disordered hyperuniformity. Because the cones are of different sizes, it's not very easy for the system to go into a crystal or ordered state. The system is frustrated from finding what might be the optimal solution, which would be the typical ordered arrangement. So while the pattern must be disordered, it must also be uniform as possible. Thus, disordered hyperuniformity is the excellent solution for that. You might think of each of these five different visual cones as hyperuniform. If you remove the red, it is still hyperuniform. And if you remove the blue ones, it still is uniform, a hyperuniform. And that is something very special, never seen in any other physical or biological system. And so if you have asked any physicist before, they would have a very hard time to find a system that is arranged in such a way. And this idea of hyperuniformity was actually discovered in 2003, so 10 years ago, and it started on a rather theoretical basis. But nowadays, the discovery of hyperuniformity in a biological system could mean that this state of matter is more common than previously thought. Until now, it has only been discovered or seen in very specialized physical systems like liquid helium, simple plasmas, and densely packed granules. But maybe it's actually very general and we find them in many places. So next time you eat a chicken, remember, bon appétit. The next story from Life Science. Are you fat? If so, blame the bacteria in your gut, or not, depending on your interpretation of the data. People who live in colder climates tend to have more of the gut microbes associated with obesity. A new study published in Biology Letters, the leading letters in biology, I assume, suggests. Researchers found that people living farther north, which, for those who are unfamiliar with geography, tends to have a colder climate, have more of the bacterial group firmicutes and few of the group's bacteriotes within their guts. Previous research has shown that people with more firmicutes bacteria tended to be heavier, while people with leaner bodies have more bacteriotes. The new findings support the hypothesis that certain obesity-associated microbial communities are too good at digesting food. Why are all the scientific terms so complicated to pronounce? So they're too good at digesting food, meaning they break down food in a way that leaves more calories available for the human beings and their host. The finding of differences in gut bacteria doesn't appear only in humans. At the Society for the Study of Evolution conference last year, Suzuki, the author of the paper, also showed that mice captured in northern parts of the United States tend to be heavier than their Floridian counterparts, Florida being in the south of the United States, and also tend to have obesity-linked microbes. Of course, the study found an association, but not a causal relationship between gut bacteria and geography, so it is very hard to say whether it's genetic differences or dietary changes or any other mechanism at play. It is very possible that people farther north tend to eat more high-fat, low-fiber animal products that fuels the growth of firmicutes at the expense of bacterials. So maybe it's the food that is linked to both obesity and the bacterial culture in your body. And yes, so it's not really clear whether the difference in gut microbes is a cause or a consequence of the colder climate. And there's a very large caveat. The new study didn't have information on subjects' body mass indexes, so it couldn't really tie the bacterial gut composition with obesity. I mean, maybe people living in northern regions are taller and thus heavier than the southerners without being obese. And again from Eureka Alert, are you fat and stupid? Well, despair no more, a simple liposuction may solve both problems, at least if you are a mouse. A new study by Dr. Shrenahan from Medical College of Georgia, which is in Georgia, United States, finds that exercise and surgically removing belly fat improves cognition in obese diabetic mice. Studies in humans and animals indicate that obesity and diabetes, which goes often hand in hand, essentially triple the risk of mild cognitive impairment as well as Alzheimer's. The study focused on the effect of fat and diabetes-associated inflammation in the brain's hippocampus, the center of learning and memory. Those obese diabetic mice have very high levels of inflammatory cytokines, possibly reacting to the invasion of fat into tissues where they do not belong, almost as if the fat were an external pathogen. Interleukin 1 beta, which is the cytokines we are talking about, are the major components of the immune response that typically targets invaders such as viruses. But in obesity, fat appears as a chronic invader that keeps the inflammation high. And obesity also weakens the protective blood-brain barrier, allowing higher concentrations of the inflammatory response to enter the brain. And once they are inside the brain, they cause the neurons to malfunction and microglia cells, which form the immune system of the brain, to consume neural synapses. So the major points of communication between brain cells. So in short, obesity causes inflammation, which causes the brain to eat itself up. And exercise and surgery lowers levels of the troublemaker in the body, which means that exercise is likely to be the best strategy. And if for patients who can't exercise, such those who are elderly or frail, it is also possible that a pharmacological intervention might help. Liposuction is not likely a viable solution, for human beings at least, because 15 to 20% of the body's fat, or of the body's weight, has to be removed for that purpose, and that is more fat than that is typical for humans. I've never done that, though, I don't know. So unless you are very desperate, don't try this. And if you are very desperate, so desperate that you would like to try this, then there might be no cure for your kind of stupidity. Oh, again, I'm very too fast. I'm too fast with the script. The following story from Life Science about SpongeBob. Well, not the actual SpongeBob. I'm using it as a pars pro toto, or in that case, rather individuum pro species. Well, pro phylum, or correctly declined, it should be pro phylo. So yes, I'm using SpongeBob SquarePants as an individuum pro phylo, referring to the sponges. Sponges may have breathed, metaphorically, life into ancient oceans. There was life before them, but they make it better. Which means you may owe your life to them. Flourishing in extreme deep ocean environments hundreds of millions of years ago, at a time when most of my listeners weren't born yet, sponges may have helped produce the oxygen required for the explosion of more complex life forms on Earth. The current theory states that plants were responsible for the oxygenation of the atmosphere, enabling oxygen-breathing animals to populate the Earth. However, a new study by Tim Lenton from University of Exeter hints that the first animals possibly were the active agents that oxygenated the ocean. They created a world in which more complex animals and simple ones like us could evolve. Sponges were the first animals to have evolved on Earth, and they don't need much oxygen to survive. In fact, a recent study in the journal Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences showed that some sponge found in Danish waters would thrive even when the oxygen level dips to 0.5% of present-day atmospheric level. Sponges do, however, contribute to the amount of oxygen in the ocean because of the way they feed. They don't have guts. Instead, they eat by filtering water through their bodies and taking out organic matter from the water column. This feeding process puts more oxygen back into the environment. This new abundance of oxygen may have provided fledgling... You know, that's a word that I should have removed from my script before. Wow. So, this abundance of oxygen may have provided other animals the extra power to gain greater mobility and evolve complex body forms like guts or brain during the Cambrian explosion, the period about half a billion years ago that saw the burst of evolutionary changes in life on Earth. These developments gave rise to the first carnivores, that's animals that eat other animals, and marked the beginning of the marine biosphere that looked, well, that is ours today. By which I mean that they gave rise to the current marine biosphere. Well, not the current one, but one that looks alike to the ones we have nowadays. Yes. Are you interested in current trends in American pornography? How about insights into the culture of pornography or the nature of sexual fantasies? If so, there is a journal for you. Life Science, being the news leader in matters concerning science and other matters, exclusively reported on the new Journal for Porn Studies published by Taylor and Francis. The journal, established since last Friday the 21st, is the first, quote, dedicated, international, peer-reviewed journal to critically explore those cultural products and services designated as pornographic. Porn may seem to be a strange prospect for research, well, at least to those who don't study at GKU, but it is a very large and influential business. The porn business in the San Fernando Valley, that I assume is in California, or any other godforsaken place, the porn business there alone was underestimated to be worth $4 billion. Pornography also plays the role of cultural scapegoat, and it is blamed from any number of years. In 2012, for example, then presidential candidate Rick Santorum, Google it up, suggested porn causes viewers profound brain changes, which probably the reason why I don't think the same as Rick does. And researchers raised a very skeptical eyebrow at that notion and said evidence for pornography's harms or benefits is very controversial. And even less is known about the effect of pornography stardom on the performance or the characteristics that make people consider a porn career. Well, the main characteristic, I assume, is money. But hey, I don't research that field. Porn Studies is an open access for a limited time only, so you can read all the arousing papers in the inaugural issue. Titles include Humanities and Social Scientific Research Methods in Porn Studies, Fair Trade Porn plus Niche Markets plus Feminist Audience. Sounds very, very interesting, especially the Fair Trade Porn part and the Feminist Audience. I mean, Fair Trade. Well, and other titles like Positionality, well, only once I just repeated the word, so incomplete, Positionality and Pornography, or Revisiting Dirty Looks, and many others that we, being a family-friendly show, will not pronounce on air. And you'll find pearls of wisdom like, I quote, "The accumulation of categories does not separate fantasies from each other, but permits flow from one fantasy to another and draws thousands of paths corresponding to more and more precise desires." Some researchers wrote who have severely studied sociology. Pornography studies, in contrast to pornography, are still in their infancy, so expect a lot of actions. That was this week's Talking Science. You may have realized some difference in quality to last week's broadcast. That's because we have a brand new mixing console since yesterday. It is so much better than the older one in that it is newer and shinier than the older one. And if you turn the volume loud enough, you might even hear me in stereo. So thank you to Betty for setting that up and other people from the Kulturreferat of the Hochschulschaft. I will now play you out with some high-quality silence, and a shout-out to all those who study hard. You are my heroes. Thank you for listening to Campus Radio Linz. I'm Boyang, and I hope that you all tune in next week at the same time to Talking Science. Thank you.
You're the devil.